And with your team, the love and the fight become the concept of connectedness. Using the social approach to deliver open online course to 3,000 students. Currently, Stephen is belongs to the National Research Council of Canada, and he's the leading of the Learning and Performance Support Systems Program, which is multi-year effort to develop personal learning and learning analytics. Personal learning technology and learning analytics. Today, Stephen will talk about MOOCs, about its conception, and about the state, the current state of MOOCs, and also how social learning can be applied in MOOCs and learning.
Sorry, I forgot to finish my slides. That's terrible. Okay. Oh, I've got I'm just finishing my slides. There we go. Sorry about that. I forgot to do the cover slide with this real nice picture from. There we go. Now it's ready. It'll be up here in just a second. So, there we go. So, thank you all for welcoming me to Santiago de Compostela. It's my first time in northwest Spain. It's a beautiful area. I love the hills. I love the sky. For a photographer, you have a wonderful sky because there's always something in it. There's clouds and shapes and all of that. I really appreciate that. And of course, there's a lot of life and a lot of culture in the city, and I've wandered around over the last 2 days, mostly jet lagged, but nonetheless very much enjoying everything your city has to say to me. So what I want to do today in this talk is talk about MOOCs and social learning networks. And what I'm going to do is take us through the idea, the fundamental idea of MOOCs, what MOOCs are, what they can be, and explore that idea from the perspective of social networks. So we begin, and it's interesting, because MOOCs started, seven years ago now, and they began as just something that George Siemens and I dreamed up at a conference in Memphis in the United States, and we just threw it onto a website thinking this would be a neat idea, and it was something that grew very much. Partly by design, but mostly by accident. And I like to say after the fact that they were able to grow because of the design. And I still believe that that's partially true. But it's interesting from my perspective to see from those beginnings what MOOCs have become over the years, and especially the way they've been taken up by institutions and especially by colleges and universities, and offered as a new form of online learning. And it's interesting to me to see the reasons why these institutions have decided to offer MOOCs. They want to extend the reach of the institution, to build their brand, to improve their economics, etc., improve educational outcomes. A lot of this is traditionally focused. It's focused on the traditional idea of the educational institution, and it's institutionally focused. It's about making the institution better to build the institution's brand, the institution's reputation. And I can say quite conclusively that this was not what George Siemens and I had in mind when we first started our first experiments in open learning. And indeed, the work that we did in this area goes back well before the beginning of MOOCs. In the introduction, it was mentioned that I came up with the concept of e-learning 2.0, which was stolen, quite frankly, from the concept of Web 2.0. But it was the idea of something that was more inclusive, more social, more collaborative. Underlying the whole idea of Web 2.0 was the idea that individuals did not just read the web, they wrote the web. And they did not just consume the web, they built the web. And it's that idea that we tried to convey with the Massive Open Online course. You know, we began not offering a MOOC. We began offering an open online course. And it was the design that allowed it to become massive. It was the design, first of all, and I think secondly, the demand that allowed it to become massive. A MOOC is only ever accidentally massive. Massive is what they would call in the literature a success term, which means that something happened. There was a successful outcome. You have to achieve a certain quantity of people to be massive. You can't build a massive course. You only achieve a massive course. So we did not build a massive course. What we built was open online learning, and it was the open that was of most significance to us. And we were inheritors of the idea of open learning, of open access. We were inheritors of what Stephen Harnad called the subversive proposal. And it was a subversive proposal in 1994. And it's still 20 years later, 21 years later now, a subversive proposal. The idea that instead of paying publishers to produce academic materials and then giving the publishers these materials for free, that we could simply produce these materials for free and then give them to ourselves. And that would change the economics of learning. And it's interesting to me, 21 years later, because I was actually around in 1994, it's interesting to me to see that that's still a subversive idea, that's still a radical proposal, although it's come a long way forward. And in no small part, I would like to think, due to MOOCs. Martin Weller talks about the way this idea took off. He talks about what he calls the open virus. And he's not talking about a virus that goes around being open. He talks about the idea of openness being this idea that spreads. And you know, he points to the roots of this original phenomena. Early adopters of open access, active bloggers, advocates of open licenses. And it was not just George Siemens and myself. It was a very large number of people who were invested in that idea, who contributed to that idea. I could spend the rest of the hour or so listing names of people who built that idea. And George and I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and things came together to create the MOOC. But it's important to understand, to my mind, that the evolution of the MOOC is a social phenomenon. It's something that a community created rather than something that individuals created. Now we're reaching the point where open access, open content, open archives are a community phenomenon. Confederation of Open Archives Repositories just recently announced a new collaboration between open archives repositories around the world. There's a set of specifications underlying that. But the idea here is that there is a network of shared and open resources that is being developed around the world. And, you know, you have this wide world of open resources, and MOOCs are one small slice of that. And that's something that is always at the forefront of my mind. The open online course is just one instantiation of the idea of open, of the idea of open learning. Now we're moving to the idea in general of what we might call an open learning network. Moving toward. I do not think that we've come anywhere close to that at this point. But the idea here, and this is from John Mott, is to build on web services from the ground up, authentication, data portability, granular authentication, rights management, etc. The idea here is to build a network of entities connected with each other in which there can be a free flow and exchange of open content. So what we see here, and what is significant for the purposes of this discussion and this conference, which I'm introducing, is the idea on the one hand that there is open learning, and on the other hand, there are networks. And the two naturally come together. With open learning, you get networks. With networks, you get open learning. And to explore what that means when we look at the connection between open learning, as we see in MOOCs, and networks, as we see in social networks. So what are social networks? Well, that might seem like a simple question, but it's not such a simple question. When we think about social networks, we think about things like, Facebook, maybe, LinkedIn, MySpace, not so much anymore, Friendster, anyone remember Friendster? Tribe? Tribe, yes, it actually existed. Twitter, of course, although, you know, I read just the other day about a phenomenon. I've forgotten the name of it, unfortunately, but it's the idea that because of the way networks work, it can look like everybody is using Twitter, when in reality, only a small proportion of the whole world is using Twitter. But you're in right in the middle of that small proportion. It's an interesting illusion, I think. Does anyone remember what it's called? The idea that it looks like, from your perspective, that everybody is doing something, when really it's just an illusion of the perspective that you have. I think it's the network illusion or something like that. It's in my notes, but I don't have my notes in front of me because I'm doing a talk. Normally, when I'm just having a conversation, I just Google something quickly, but I've learned that's bad form when you're giving a talk. Stop talking and do Google right in the middle of it. The concept of the social network even extends beyond that. And, of course, there's dozens of what can be called corporate social networks. SAP has them, IBM has them, Cisco has them. And they're all the same concept. You have an identity. You have a list of friends. you have a way of connecting with your list of friends, and there may be social environments like wikis or discussion lists, maybe even an area where you can have a live chat or a synchronous conversation or whatever. And it's interesting because I work on the corporate side a lot these days. I work for the National Research Council, which is a federal government research institution. So it's not a college, it's not a university. I see a lot of these corporate networks, and sometimes they're used. Usually they're used by the people who built them, and it's a stretch to get the rest of the corporation to use them. And, you know, it's like Charlene Lee says in Harvard Business Review, employees are smart. They won't waste their time on stunts that are purely for show. There's a mismatch, to my mind, between the social network as it's traditionally constructed, like Facebook or even Twitter or LinkedIn, and getting stuff done. These two ideas don't line up nicely. We'll explore that a little bit. But let me come back to the concept of open. Let me come back to the concept of open online learning, open online courses. It's one of these things that people sometimes have this single thought about. The word is univocal, right? They see it with one idea, one mind, one voice. And they don't break down the different components of it. And they should. If the creators of the Stanford AI MOOC or Coursera or Udacity had thought about it a little bit, they would have seen that there is a lot of nuance to the concept of open online learning. So James C. Taylor, not to be confused with the musician, from Southern Queensland University, described what he called the logic model for open education. I don't completely agree with this, but the idea is sound, that there's a progression, maybe a progression, certainly a typology, between the different types of open that you're going to have. Beginning with, typically, open content, but then moving through the different aspects of learning. Now, what I'm going to do for the remainder of this talk, so you can sort of see what's happening, is to go through this typology, think about this typology from the perspective of open learning, and think about this typology from the perspective of social networking. And the idea here is not to give you a bunch of answers, but the idea here is to try to stimulate thinking across a wider range of what is possible when you think of open online courses and you think of social networking. So we'll begin where all of the discussions of open education begin, with the idea of open access, or as it's sometimes called, open admissions. This is the idea that originated, I think, with Britain's Open University, and followed very quickly thereafter by organizations like Athabasca University in Canada. That's Athabasca University pictured. I used to work there. Not in that building, though. That's a building in a small town of about 500 people located in the Canadian wilderness about an hour and a half north of Edmonton in Alberta. And by wilderness, I mean wilderness. There's a river, and then if you go north of that river, there's nothing but forest until you hit the North Pole. Nothing. Literally nothing. Well, there's tundra, and then there's some sea, and there's ice, and more ice, and more ice. That's if you go straight north. If you go straight west from Athabasca, same forest. You cross the river again because it kind of loops. More forest, mountains, and then ocean, and then Japan. If you go east from Athabasca, forest, more forest, tundra, rock, Hudson's Bay, tundra, rock, Atlantic Ocean. That's it. I say tundra rock because there's forest in the west of Canada and tundra in the east, in the north, right? And if you go south from Athabasca, forest, farmland, city of Edmonton, really busy highway, city of Calgary, farmland, nothing, Las Vegas. So, it's kind of in the middle of nowhere, but it's a beautiful place, and that's where they decided to put the Open University for Canada, was there, because why not? So, I lived in Edmonton while I worked for Athabasca. I lived in a place called Peace Country, which is some farmland surrounded by forest in northwestern Alberta. It's all beautiful country. But the idea here, again, is you could set up the university, set up ways of accessing that university built on communications channels like telephone lines or fiber internet or radio. When I was in Australia, I had the privilege of visiting the School of the Air, which provided access to learning by radio signals to sheep stations all across Australia, where, again, you get these places right in your place, nothing. And if you set it up in that way, you could have an abundance of learning. And with the abundance of learning, you did not have a shortage of spaces. You did not have to go through a formal admissions process, and so anybody could take part in that education. And I saw firsthand the success of that model by teaching many, many students over the years who never would have gotten into a traditional university. They did not have high school grades, they did not have the time, because they worked full-time or they were mothers at home. They did not have the money because it's expensive. And so open access, open admissions, changed the model of what we think of as a university. So what happens when we take that concept and merge it with the concept of the network? Well, it's an odd mix, and it doesn't jump out at you immediately. Wikipedia for Open Access Network, I just looked it up because I was curious, describes it as the business model that separates the physical access to the network from the delivery of services. In an open access network, the owner or manager of the network does not supply services for the network. These services must be supplied by separate retail service providers. So what would that be like? Well, it's a bit like a cable television provider, perhaps, which provides wires. But normally the cable television provider does not provide the television channels. That's some other country or some other company. Unless you're in Canada, in which case there you have the same company providing the wires as providing the TV channels. But what's important here is it creates a separation in concept between the provision of the service, in our case education, and the provision of access to that service. In our case, well, what? The internet, maybe, telephone lines, TV stations, etc. And I think that this turns out, and people will say historically, that this separation of concept turns out historically to be a significant moment, because previously education and access to education were managed by the same people and managed very tightly, and they kept it to themselves, and they did not allow access to education to people unless they qualified in some way or another. And education was the bastion of a privileged few. And this is an idea that's been challenged over the years. And it's challenged by this concept of open access as a network phenomenon. So what happens when we take that concept and merge it with social networks? Well, now it becomes weird and distorted. And it's a strange sort of thing. There have been a bunch of stories like this. I've just picked one almost at random. It's about admissions in the United States, because there's a huge literature on that. And the focus of the story is that a university was going to admit a student, but before doing that, they looked at their Facebook account, or in this case, they looked at their Twitter account, and they were horrified. They saw the real person, and they decided, we do not want that person in our university. And so it's almost like we've gone full circle, right? When we had an open access network, everything was good and people were getting into universities and it was great. Now we have open access social networks, and all of a sudden our own forms of interaction with each other are being used as barriers to admission to the university system. So it's a funny sort of turn of events. And I think it presses the idea that social networks are not automatically, what's the word I want to use, equalizers. They're not automatically ways of granting people access to something like education. That there's two sides to it. That on the one hand, they can open doors, but on the other hand, they can be used to close doors. Okay, well, that's open access. What about open source? Open source is interesting. Open source is not something we normally think of, interestingly, when we talk about massive open online courses. But open source certainly formed the heart of what George and I did. One of the things we tried to do was make not just the course open access, but all the workings of the course, the way we built it, the software we put it together with. We used Moodle, for example, which is open access software. We used Grasshopper, which I wrote, which is also open access. We described what we were doing. We documented what we were doing. And if we were better, we would have used GitHub or whatever. But we weren't, so we didn't know. Open source, the definition is software that can be freely used, changed, or shared in modified or unmodified form by anyone. It's made by many people and distributed under licenses that comply with the open source definition, which is kind of circular, but we'll leave that aside. Licensing is important in open source software. The license that you have to software is what tells you what you can do with that software. One of the key conditions of open source software licenses was that they are viral. And what that means is, if you license a piece of software with a certain condition and somebody uses that software for something else, the license conditions travel with it. If they change that software and make something new, the license condition travels with it. So whatever you started with, that's what you end up with, is viral licensing. And the idea is to keep open software. I remember back in the days I used to program what were called multi-user dungeons, or MUDs. These are multiplayer online games, and they're built by people like Descartes of Bourg, more properly known as George Rees, what was his name, Lars Penske, who built the renowned LPMUD code. And the big concern of developers around this time is that they would release their code, complex code for a multi-user online system. This is back in the early 1990s. And somebody would come along, change a line of their code, say, oh, now it's different. So now it's something that I created, and now you have to pay me money. Because now they didn't like this. Descartes would spend years building his code library, which he called Nightmare. And somebody come along and say, no, this is the Nightmare OS. and now you have to pay money. So they began to put conditions into their licenses such that if you took the code and made a change to it, you still had to keep the license. And that's the origin of viral licensing. And then Richard Stallman later came along and codified this under the heading of free software and the four freedoms that are defined as part of free software. Freedom freedom to use, freedom to read, freedom to share, freedom to modify. The key here is that as software went from person to person to person to person, the license traveled with it, and the freedom that it started with traveled with it as well. Interesting and important concept. So it's not surprising that very quickly, 20 years later, but I guess it wasn't that quick. You got open source networks. Back in the days of MUDs and things that had bulletin board systems and these things traveled very slowly. It was a network called FidoNet, and you actually had to hop your software along from one phone number to another phone number, always local to avoid long-distance charges, because who could afford long-distance charges? Well, you'd send your software over to the next town, and they'd send it over to the next town, and it was all developed automatically so that the software would just hop from location to location and spread, as Martin Weller said, like a virus. So SourceForge was the most important of these for many years, and then later on GitHub. And the idea of both of these is you can contribute your software to a community. The community takes up the software, modifies it, maybe creates their own version, which is a process known as forking, and passes it on one person to the next, collaborates together, shares in the building of the software. And the software becomes this object that forms the center of a community. And it's a model that's worked very well. And we know that it's worked very well. It's a model that George and I were certainly very familiar with when we built the first MOOC, and we were certainly inspired by it. So what happens when that turns into social networks? Well, not a lot. What I found when I looked, and I should have known because I'm familiar with both of these systems, is that basically the next generation almost sort of corporate versions of social networks / GitHub subversion kind of systems, except that they're not. Basically, it's social networks 2.0, if you will, or corporate social networks 2.0, where these are conferencing systems, collaboration systems, enabling teams to work together to develop and build projects. not just software projects, although they can be used for that, but other projects as well. And XO, which is pictured here, and Slack, which is pictured here, are the most recent of these, and these days the most widely used of these, but there has been a steady iteration of this concept over the years. So you basically have the concept here of production of whatever, software is the obvious example, and social networking combining. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. There's an article by Matthias Emrose in Medium where he asks whether Slack could not be the next learning management system. And my answer is no, for various reasons. But consider the argument. Learning is constructed by what activities the students carry out. Learning is about what they do rather than what teachers do. And the whole point of these environments is to give people a place and the capacity to do things. It's not simply about sharing content. It's about interacting and building something. Well, I find that an interesting concept, and so I find Slack as the new LMS an interesting concept in itself. Although it's interesting, and let's keep ourselves historically grounded here, social networking and interaction in education has a history in a package called ELD, developed by Dave Tosh and Ben Werdmuller, which, again, was intended to use social networking and collaborative interaction in order to pursue educational objectives. But I think the difference between ELD and these is that these are very specifically production-focused, task-focused applications. So that's interesting. It's a different kind of picture of a MOOC, right? Normally, you think of Coursera, Udacity, etc. You think, oh, I'm going to watch some videos. But here, you go to Slack, you actually have to do things. Open content. Open content was originally thought of as similar to open source. The beginnings of open content, quote-unquote, if you will, are probably the new free documentation license, or GFDL, which was the license that was attached to documentation that came with the original open source software distributed by people like Richard Stallman. And the idea was that the documentation would be free, basically under the same terms as the software itself. Although, interestingly, Stallman put a no derivatives clause into the documentation, so you couldn't change the documentation, which I thought was very odd. Open content, well, David Wiley has become the name, if you will, in open content, and created his own open content license, followed not long after by Creative Commons open content licenses. And these days, I think, open content is considered to be more or less synonymous with the concept of open content licensing. If you think open content, you think Creative Commons, pretty much. I've had long arguments with Creative Commons people about whether open content means the same as commercial content. And I think that's a difficult question. I think it's a difficult question because I license all of my content using a non-commercial license. And there's a reason for that. I want my content to always be available without cost. And to me, open content means content that is available without cost. But the open source licenses developed by Stallman, not by Descartes, but by Stallman, and the Creative Commons licenses allowed for commercial distribution of the software as well, commercial distribution of the content, which means that it could be open content but they're still charging you money for it. Me, I just scratch my head. But it's a concept that makes sense to Americans. That's all I can say. It's just, I argue with them, and it's, they just see it differently. They see the denial of commercialization of anything as a restraint of trade, as a restriction on what you can do with the thing. And I see it as the opposite. I see commercialization of something as a restriction of access to the thing. They just don't see it that way. So, okay. So we have now in education the content mills, if you will, which is the second generation of MOOCs that came along. And I should back up, because there is a history there too, and it's kind of a separate parallel history. But from the idea of open access and from the idea of open archives, the subversive proposal distributed by Stephen Hernad, came the concept at MIT of open courseware, as they called it. And then from open courseware, you get the idea of open courses. And so there's this sort of separate non-MOOC track that takes you into the idea of open courses online. And it's arguable that the people who developed Coursera and Udacity and the rest had no idea whatsoever about the whole rest of the world outside of their own institutions. And so they saw this as a natural progression. And what do? For open education, you take your courses, you put them online, you have some videos of the instructor, you call that open learning. And that's what they did. So we got Coursera, we got Udacity, we got edX, we got the rest of them. What happens when we take these and add the concept of the network to it? Well, not a lot. It's interesting. Well, I did a search on this because I was curious. Again, I'd like to prepare for these talks. And so I searched open content network, not really knowing what I find. I thought I'd find the open content network, which I did. But I found this thing, the SAP Community Network. Now, SAP, or SAP, is, it's, how do I want to describe it? Besides this multi-headed hydra, or alternatively, the worst software ever built. No, that's not kind to the makers of the second worst software ever built. it's enterprise management software. It's human resources software. It's project management software. It's budgeting and accounting and spreadsheet software. And large companies use this horrible, horrible 1980s software to manage their financial systems. If you ever wonder why companies seem to be run so badly, it's because of the tools that they're using, honestly. But I babble. I babble only because I have to work with this software. Like I said, I spend a fair amount of time on the corporate side of things. So, SuccessFactors is the SAP learning management system, and SuccessFactors has introduced, quote, the open content network for the SuccessFactors learning product. And it's the extension of the LMS allows for integration with a few select MOOC providers to incorporate a vendor's courses into the organization's LMS, which would be, of course, SuccessFactors. This can allow organizations to present online courses from the MOOC providers to employees within the LMS directly. And I'm sort of scratching my head because I'm like, why would you do this? Because, sorry about that, the sound guy in the back is going, no, no, my ears. And the answer is these corporate networks run on an intranet. In many cases, internet access is not even available. In large parts of our network, it's not available. In my part, it is, happily. Otherwise, I'd go crazy. And the only way to access these open courses is through a special agreement that they've made to make these open courses accessible inside your network. It's crazy. It's craziness. And so the Open Content Network is allowing open courses to be accessed from within your learning management system. Not really what I had in mind when I looked for this concept online. And it sort of shows you some of the challenges, I think, of open content networks when what people think of as a network is SAP, the enterprise system that manages employees and produces paychecks and stuff like that. What I expected to find was something like Emma, which I already knew about. In fact, I'll be visiting them and speaking in Italy sometime in the fall. The European Multiple MOOC Aggregator, and this is very similar to something that I built called MOOC.ca, and it's interesting thinking about that. These things are all, I was thinking about this morning, because I've done lots of these sorts of things, and they're all moments. You have history, and in history you have your own segment, which is, you know, your life or your productive life for today or whatever. And then through this history, you have different technologies that come and go, right? Tribe, MySpace, Facebook, LinkedIn, whatever. And in education technology, it's the same sort of thing. So you have, you know, learning objects come and go, e-learning 2.0, content repositories. And so each one of these things is a moment. And so MOOCs, it's a moment. And then MOOC aggregators is a moment. And so MOOC aggregation is a moment on this timeline. And it's interesting to me because, to me, they're all moments. And you move quickly from one to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, because what else would you do? But people don't. And it's fascinating. They find a moment, and they attach themselves to that moment. And thereafter, they build a career around that moment. And it's a good strategy because every one of these moments exists because it is productive. And the people who are building Emma have seized on this moment and they're building around this moment. People who, you know, I think of ePortfolios, Helen Barrett, right? ePortfolios comes along, it's a moment, Helen Barrett. ePortfolios, I will build a career on this. And she's still doing it. And why not? And in my own history, I'm constantly tempted by these moments and saying, I should stop here and build this and stay on this, but I can't. And that's why I don't have a steady job, really. Well, I do have a steady job, but that's why I don't invent things so much as I move on to the next moment. Sorry, that was a bit of an aside. I think it's interesting. So the MOOC aggregator is a moment. MOOC.ca is a moment. MOOC aggregation, it's a neat idea. It's still on the rise. The idea, because, you know, SAP, although SAP is doing it, but SAP's doing it only with selected partners. But the idea of aggregating all the massive open courses out there to create an open content network, still a good idea. Still a moment. Still something worth doing. Okay, so that's open content networks. What do we think of an open content social network? Well, here's what I came up with. The diagram on the left is Scott Wilson's diagram of the personal learning environment. The diagram on the right is the diagram of the MOOCs that George Siemens and I created. So what is an open content social network? Well, it has to be a social network. Okay, that makes sense. Social network, you have many interactions with many people. And we are interacting with these many people by means of open content. Well, that makes sense. And the internet used to be like that. It's changed a bit since then, in a sense. We used to interact by means of blogs and other artifacts, photographs, cartoons, sometimes multimedia, sometimes videos, and that's how we would interact. And that was good. Now, not so much. I found it very interesting. I've been harvesting RSS feeds for many years. That was another moment, right? That was back in 2003, 2004, RSS feeds. I built something called EduRSS. Could have made a career doing that. But we used to create these things and send them around to each other. Now we don't create these things anymore. And in my own RSS aggregator, there's a list, I don't know, it's hundreds, 200, 300, I haven't counted them, hundreds of abandoned blogs where people used to write every day, or at least every week, and now they haven't written in a year, 2 years, 3 years. I still have the whole list. And it's very depressing. And so what are they doing now? I'll tell you what they're doing now, because now they're all in social networks. And instead of creating things, they're reading things that they've seen from places like Gawker and Medium and Huffington Post, some YouTube, single link YouTube videos, etc. I noticed my aggregator, the consultants section, is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Consultants are really feeding this mill. And so they're not exchanging objects with each other anymore that they've created. They're exchanging links. They send links to each other. They send a link to a photo. They send a link to an article that was produced by a doctor, which is actually paid media or whatever. I find it sad, really. Open content social network has resulted in the death of open content, or more accurately, in the commodification of open content, where it's easier just to share a link of something that somebody was paid to write than to write something yourself. And I think we've lost something there. Known at the bottom there is just a reminder that there is a project out there by Ben Wertmuller, who previously created ELG, to create a website that collects all of these different places of Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, etc. in your own website, your own environment. And there's this whole, there's a movement. I don't know if I want to call it a movement. There's a something that might become a moment one day. Ben calls it IndieWeb with a hashtag. Right? Hashtag IndieWeb, because we don't actually use words anymore. We use hashtags. Jim Groom calls it Domain of One's Own, which is sort of odd because I don't know why he didn't use Domain of Your Own. That would have been better. Or Domain of My Own, but Domain of One's Own. And I think there's a bit of a salacious association with the Seinfeld episode behind that naming. But the idea, again, is to have and control your own online web presence. And maybe, just maybe, if we do that, we'll get back to writing our own content again. I hope so. So, What if you have open content and you apply it to education? You have open educational resources, properly so called. And this conversation is very similar to the conversation about open content. Open educational resources, says UNESCO, are any type of educational materials that are in the public domain or introduced with an open license. There's the equivalence of licensing and content again. The nature of these open materials means that anyone can legally and freely copy, use, adapt, and reshare them. Implicit in the definition, implicit in the concept of share, is the concept of sell. And it's, just as an aside, it's fascinating that there's this whole economy that is developing that is called the sharing economy, but which is about selling. Airbnb, for example, is where you share your house by renting out a room to somebody. Or Uber is a model where you share your car by charging somebody money to drive them somewhere. This is the idea. This is the new sharing economy. When I was a kid, I learned about sharing, and I didn't get any money back when I did it. So you're probably saying, the other thing I want to point out about this, and I put this here deliberately, the logo with the raised hand, right? And there's still this association between education and the very traditional classroom model where you have to ask permission in order to speak. And I know it's you know, there's a million videos and photographs of children in classrooms all going, and that shows educational success. But is this success? It's not success. It's like somebody waiting for permission to speak. And to me, that's the anti-success. It's failure. If a person has to wait and be recognized in order to speak, to me that is failure. Anyhow, but that's an aside. So, take the concept of network and apply it to open educational resources. And you have open educational resource networks. That was a moment whose time has passed. Oddly, I was involved with it in the early 2000s, 2001, 2002. We built the EduSource repository network in Canada that no longer exists. There are these networks. They're out there. Globe, for example, which associates a bunch of open educational repository networks around the world, and they exist. There's Merlot in the United States, but there's no real recorded instances of people using them, and it's a very odd sort of phenomenon. The idea is that you spend a lot of money, create a whole bunch of open educational resources, put them in a big pile somewhere, called a repository, and then they'll be used. And they're not used. David Wiley wrote about the reusability paradox. And the reusability paradox is the more specific something is to a particular purpose, the less useful it is in other purposes. But the broader you make something, the less useful it is for any particular purpose. So there's no real way of reusing a reusable resource. And it's something that's bothered me a lot because there's so much in the idea of open educational resources that is based on the idea of a teacher or developer finding this resource, bringing it to their institution or their classroom, modifying it in some way, and then sharing it or using it in their classroom. And that's the picture, and that's why the hand is raised, because it's a classroom, right? And I don't think teachers actually work that way. I don't think people actually work that way a whole lot. The only thing that really does work that way at all is open source software. But if you actually go look at SourceForge and GitHub and that, you find that even that doesn't really work that way. That people don't so much take someone else's project and modify it as they start their own project, because that's what they do. So I think we need a different model, a different way of thinking about the use and sharing of open educational resources. One that is less focused on the idea of teachers using them, reshaping them, and then applying them in their classroom. Well, what is that model? Well, there's another way of looking at these things. And I have the link here on this page to something called Utopia. It's called, Utopia Publishing or something like that. What it is, it's a plugin for PDF viewers. And so you're reading your PDF, and it produces a sidebar of related material for you. So you're just reading along, you know, Tom Sawyer, and a sidebar, Huckleberry Finn, Life on the Mississippi, a Connecticut Yankee and Quinoa, whatever. And that's kind of a neat idea. And I know that there's similar resources available in Microsoft Word, where you can get a sidebar of related resources that are within your own network, right? And I've built stuff, this is back in my EduRSS days, where you'd be reading one article, and in the sidebar you'd have other articles by the same author, or other articles from the same publication, or other articles on the same topic. And that's kind of getting there to where you want to go. Well, let's take it one step further then. OER social network. What does that bring us? Well, again, I wasn't really able to think off the top of my head of any OER social network, so I did a search and found this one. It's a presentation by Alexandra Okada. It's quite a good presentation. You should have a look at it. It's a couple of years old now. It's about co-learning, collaborative networks for creating, sharing, and reusing OERs through social media. And there's a thing in it called Open Scout. So I think that's a good idea, except, again, I'm not so sure that people share and reuse OERs at all. But if they are going to, it's probably going to be through social media. Because what do we do in social media? We pass on links. And what could the link be to? Well, the link could be to an open educational resource. So we have this sort of sense where social media could be this place where we exchange links to open educational resources. No real word about how these things get built. Okay, maybe. Something to think about. Open instruction. Now, this is where our MOOCs tried to be different from what we were saying before. What we wanted to do was make not just the content of learning open. We wanted to make the actual act of teaching and learning open. And so we didn't just open up our materials. We opened up, if you will, our online classroom. And that's what created the rush, right? And we had a whole bunch of people coming to us, and they were able to take part in our open online class. We weren't the first to do this. Alec Koros had his Education Foundations course, which he taught as an open course. David Wiley put one of his courses into a wiki, not quite open instruction, but kind of close. So we wanted to bring in all of the elements, not just the resources, but the lectures, the talks, the activities, the projects, everything into this open environment. Jim Groom, with his DS-106 course, had an open assignment bank, still has, an open assignment bank where people contribute ideas for neat digital storytelling assignments, and then other people in the course come along and do the assignment and get credit for it. So that's pretty cool. I like that. It's a good model. So what would an open instruction network look like? So open teaching, maybe, the course that we did, certainly we were given credit for that by the Chronicle of Higher Education. Alex Koros came up with the idea of the network Sherpa. So you have a bunch of open teachers who are all teaching their open classes, and then you have a Sherpa who works with those open teachers, taking them together through their open class. That's a neat idea. It'd be difficult to pull off technologically because, you know, like, it's difficult. It's really difficult to get, you know, a group of teachers to do the same thing at the best of times. And when you're open teaching, that can be even more difficult. But it's an interesting idea. And the idea here is that the Sherpa, if you will, is someone who knows the terrain, who's been through this concept of open teaching before, has an understanding of the pedagogy, has an understanding of previous practices, what's worked, what hasn't worked, etc. Just as a sidebar, just for fun, when I searched on Google for open instruction networks, and I was again preparing for this talk, this came up, this Google Deep Dream project, and what Google does is crazy. So what it does is it takes an image and it runs it through a neural net processor. And the neural net processor has been previously trained to recognize certain types of things. So one of the good ones is it's been trained to recognize dogs. And so it looks at a picture, well, Brian Alexander has one. It looks at a picture of Brian Alexander, and he's a dog with a big beard. In this one, it's trained to recognize pagodas. And so here's a landscape, but everywhere there was kind of a pagoda-shaped figure, it put a pagoda. That's a hard word. And open instruction network. There's something linking these two concepts of pattern detection in neural networks and open instruction. I'll have to tease it out. But I find it interesting that Google search gave me this when I was looking for that. But I do think the things are related. I do think that the idea of open teaching is in many respects also a process of pattern recognition. But that's an interesting sidebar. Open instruction social network. Beyond Coral's Sherpa concept, I haven't seen anything at all resembling this, except maybe this example from Jingguang Li. On privacy preservation models for health-related social networking sites. And in my own work, I find there's a lot of overlap between education and health, particularly with respect to sharing of information. In health especially, there's a lot of concern about privacy, especially in the United States, because if insurers learn that you have some condition, they'll take away your insurance and then you die. So that's a bad thing. And so the preservation of privacy becomes very important related to health. Education less so, but it's becoming more so. And I'm finding that the idea of giving instruction in an open network, in an open social network, is meeting some of the same resistance points as sharing information about health in the health network. It's not clear that people are comfortable with learning in an open social network. And what's interesting is not the fact that they're not comfortable. What's interesting is why are they not comfortable? And they're not comfortable, well, and now again, we're into the territory of speculating, right? There's room for a big investigation there if you're looking for big investigations. Why are people uncomfortable? And they're uncomfortable because they fear being judged. They're uncomfortable because they're talking about private moments. They're uncomfortable because they may make mistakes, which would be seen by potential future employers. They're uncomfortable because it opens them to abuse and bullying. You can see there's a concern. There's a limit to the openness that can happen in an instructional scenario. But I'm not convinced that all of these fears are valid, first of all. And there's a line somewhere. I don't know where that line is. But it's worth investigating. It's worth thinking about. Open design. Again, we're going through many of the same sort of concepts here. We have originally the idea of learning design, learning patterns, open educational practices, the idea of formalizing in some way the methods and the pedagogies that are used in order to deliver or support education both in person and online. It's something that we've seen develop over the last 10, 15 years or so. The question is, what does this become when it comes into a network? And Gronje Knol, who was going to be here and unfortunately had an accident, a dancing accident, and is now in a cast, will not be here, sadly, but she's talked about CloudWorks social networking for learning design. And what I thought was interesting in this, and she cites back to Engstrom, and the concept actually goes back further still, the idea of social networking as mediated by the objects that, as is said there, mediate the ties between people. And the concept of a mediating object is one that is familiar to, through many theories of communication. There's also the concept of building knowledge through these objects, the way ants build an anthill, and that's known as stigmergy. And so what we have here is building knowledge of pedagogy, building knowledge of learning design, learning patterns, etc., by building these artifacts. And these artifacts then, hence, become the things that are shared in social media. And I think there's a rightness to that, but I think there's a wrongness to that. I think it's right in the sense that there are these things that get passed from person to person to person, or perhaps maybe more accurately that each of us over time encounter, and there is a difference between those two concepts. I'm not sure necessarily that we should be thinking of them strictly as objects. I've talked about in the past communication in social networks as a form of language, which kind of makes sense because we are communicating, and instead of using words, we're using artifacts. I talked earlier in this talk about we pass links around. Back in the good old days of blogs and other things, we would pass articles around, photographs around, etc. I called the concept speaking in lolcats. Speaking in the form of images, speaking in the form of cartoons that we've created, speaking in the form of things that we share. And I think that's probably closer to what's happening here. there is a stigmergic aspect to this. There is this sense that we're building a common object. But I think more to the point, we're using this object to talk to each other rather than we're using this object as a place where we're sharing and creating something in common. The object travels, but the object isn't something that we're all invested in building, I don't think. Taking this one step further to the open learning design social networks, and as you can see, we're gradually becoming more and more complex with our idea, more and more complex with our concept. So I found something called the Connected Learning Research Network, which is a good idea, a model based on evidence that the most resilient, adaptive, and effective learning involves individual interest as well as social support, etc. So the idea, this is more along the lines of people who are in education, sharing practices, talking with each other. And I think we're moving away from pure network where we're focused on the object, and more into social network where we're focused more on the communication. So what else could there be in open learning? Well, how about open credentials? There's been some talk in MOOCs about credentials and, you know, Coursera and Udacity now. If you give them money, they will give you credentials. But the idea of open learning is that you don't give them money. And so that leads us to the idea of open credentials. But what are open credentials? Badges? Are there any other alternatives? Well, what if we take the idea of open credentials and we attach it to a network? Well, the network really supports the idea of badges. And the way it supports the idea of badges is in a couple of ways. First of all, it allows you to get credentials from multiple sources. And right away, that's a bit of a distinction from a traditional university degree where all your courses came from the same place. This is a concept where your credentials can be built by getting recognition from a number of different places. And as well, the idea of the network allows there to be a link back to whoever issued the credential. And you might not think that that's significant, but as soon as you apply for a job or a postgraduate program and you need to send your transcript to somewhere, it becomes significant because it raises the question, who owns the transcript? Who owns the credential? At a minimum, a credentials network at least allows you a way of connecting back to the issuer of that credential. One wonders if there couldn't be, maybe this is another moment, a credential aggregator, like a MOOC aggregator that aggregates credentials from multiple credentials. Anyhow, you get the idea. So, what happens if we take this concept and apply it to social networks? What do credentials become in social networks? Well, this is my LinkedIn page, or at least part of my LinkedIn page, and it's the skills and endorsements that I've received, mostly unjustly. I mean, it's nice to see that I've got 99-plus people giving me props for qualitative research and higher education and science and research design. Someone over here gave me credit for, LaTeX. I confess, I know what LaTeX is. And I, you know, I don't mean the cloth-like material. I mean the scripting language. But to say that I know about it, no. But, you know, maybe a credential is how we're seen by the rest of the world. And maybe a credential you know, like maybe a university credential is just a shortcut for a much more complex system that we're now actually almost capable of implementing. And maybe something like this is what an open credentials network would look like. Well, not, you know, that. You know, that's the clout of credentials. It's clout is a site that counts the number of tweets you got and counts the number of Facebook likes you got and adds it all up and gives you a media influence score. And it's ridiculous. And of course, we don't have an influence score. We don't have these credentials. You know, you don't get them just by counting the number of times somebody said, oh yeah, you're good at qualitative research. But what if it was just the experts? What if there was a way of sorting these so that only the people who were actually in a position to know whether you're an expert in something could say you're an expert in something? And what if it didn't? Like, this depends on somebody actually coming to my Facebook or my LinkedIn page and clicking a button. What if it depended instead on somebody reading stuff that I wrote, responding to something that I wrote, citing something that I wrote in one of their papers? What if it depended on actual use of the concepts that I discussed in other people's work? And what if that was all measured by measuring social network activities? Well, then maybe if we construed social networks widely enough, it would be possible to come up with open credentials like that. Maybe. It would be a form of open assessment. It would be an assessment where we would have an expert judge our work. The expert would be implicit. The expert would be discoverable by the network. And the judgment would be given weight by the expert. It would be the result of a learning outcomes assessment community, if you will, that was actually doing other things. It'd be an open assessment network. It'd be an open assessment network based less on content-based formal learning and more on task-based informal learning. It would be a network that, you know, like the open source networks, didn't look at what I said I could build, because there are a million script kiddies out there who say, I can hack into your site or whatever. It would look at what you actually built and how much what you're actually building is used by other people. So, open assessment, social network, maybe what we do in Facebook really will become the assessment of the 21st century. Maybe what we say on Twitter really will be what our degrees are based on. Or maybe it'll be something more substantial. Maybe it'll be something much more, I'm looking for a word here, widespread, something that's much more embedded into our daily lives, our professional life, and our work life. I think it comes back to, and I've talked in the past about the Downs model of learning, which is not original to me and is too simple to be called a theory or a model. But I think that as we have open courses, as we have MOOCs, we have a place where both teachers and learners can model and demonstrate. And that's where the teaching happens, that's where the assessment happens, that's where the credentialing happens. And then the learning takes place on the personal level with personal learning, and in the personal learning environment, it's the place where we practice and reflect on things, where we discuss, where we get support, where we do things, where we undertake activities. And in the end, there's no real difference between these two environments. The place where we're practicing and reflecting is also the place where we're modeling and demonstrating. And it's an iterative process, and you go through it, and you go through it, and you go through it. And as you leave artifacts, sometimes known as open learning resources, sometimes known as open content, sometimes known as whatever, that becomes the grounds on which you become assessed and earn your credentials, your new credentials in this new social networking environment for learning. Something like that, maybe. Something to think about beyond just Udacity and Coursera and online videos and Khan Academy. And that's what I've got. So I thank you very much for your time and your patient attention.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. What's your opinion about the current MOOCs? What's your opinion about the current MOOCs? Do you think that they combine social networks with open social networks with
the current MOOCs?
Yeah.
No. I know that because I've seen websites, groups that have been formed around these MOOCs, outside these MOOCs, where people are desperately trying to communicate with each other. And I see people organizing their own meetups in different towns and places completely outside the structure of these MOOCs. So, you know, there's the current MOOC right now, the Coursera, Udacity, edX, etc., exists basically as a destination website where there are, you know, some content, materials, videos, production, etc., perhaps some activities, but all of these are activities in the sense that they're like online games. They're automated. They're interactive, but you're interacting basically with an algorithm. And the social interaction that happens outside of that is developed almost completely by the students themselves. There have been efforts in this environment to generate social interaction, but they've echoed, in my mind, they've echoed some of the abortive and failed attempts of the past. You know, there was an effort, for example, to have a discussion board. And it's classic. The first thing everybody does on a discussion board is they introduce themselves. That's the first thread, right? Introduce yourself. So several thousand introductions. My name is... And from there, the discussion sort of peters off. Because who can read several thousand introductions? There was another attempt, which again met with disaster, where somebody, I forget her name, attempted to automatically create groups out of the tens of thousands of people in her course. And what you would get is groups of 10 people, each of which had one active member in it, which was not useful. So, you know, I think there's a recognition on their part that they need to support the social side, but I don't think there's an understanding of how this can be done and how this could be done certainly on a massive scale.
Okay, thank you. Another question is, I think that in your opinion, the main point of a MOOC is the open factor.
Yes.
Okay. Then, if you construct a course with openness, the open factor,
mm-hmm.
People share
mm-hmm.
contents and opinions. And that could be considered a MOOC.
Yeah. Okay. So, because what's the difference between that and the moon, right? Because, sure, the internet is a place where people create content and share, right? What's the difference between the internet and the moon? So, I explain to people. A MOOC has a start and it has an end. And it's usually focused around some topic. Focused. It's not about a topic, but it's focused around the topic. And so people start and they interact and they share and all of that. And then at a certain point, they stop. Although I've discovered they don't always stop. But that's okay. Why would we do that? You might ask. And what I find is a MOOC is like a temporary network, right? And because it's temporary, we're able to join this network without making the same sort of social commitment that we would to joining a permanent full-time network. It's like when you visit a city instead of living in a city. Right? Yeah. You live in a city, you're committed. You have to pay your power bill. You have to arrange for sewage. And who wants to arrange for sewage? You visit a city, the hotel does that, right? So it's like being in a network but with less commitment. And what happens, and this is why it's useful, is when you create a temporary network, now you've loosened the conditions for making new ties, new connections. And so you make a whole bunch of new ties, new connections. You see the world in different ways because you're hearing from people that you might never hear from otherwise because it was low risk, right? So, sure, I'll talk to this person from India because I'm not committing to a lifetime relationship with them. I'm just committing to the next 4 weeks, so I'll take the time. And then I see the world in a different way. And so it does for us, I'm trying to describe it exactly. It does for us what annealing does in a mineral. Annealing is a process where you take a piece of iron or some other metal and you heat it up and then you cool it down. And you might think, well, why would you do that? Because when you heat it up and cool it down, it gets stronger. Because you've shaken up or you've rearranged all the bonds in this element. And that's what happens in the mind. You shake it up with a temporary network, and then you allow it to settle out again. And when you do that, you get something stronger than what you started with. And it's a known phenomenon in connectionist theory, neural network modeling, called Boltzmann mechanisms. And a Boltzmann mechanism basically is you loosen the requirements for a connection to form, and then you gradually tighten them up again. And so a course does that. A course is like annealing for learning. A course allows us temporary connections that open us to new possibilities, and then gradually we can reform them.
Okay, my question is,
and the microphone lasted that long. Oh, there we go.
What do you think? I think that the problem of your MOOC, your first MOOC, and then the X MOOC, and the movement around the book, the MOOCs, mm-hmm. the X MOOCs, is the institutionalization of the MOOCs, and what happened with the credentials, they appropriate the language and the idea, but they adapt the idea to their objectives, to their name.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think about the future of the open access content, assessment, learning, teaching, everything that you introduced? I think it is a very big problem, because everything was, you know what happened with that, okay?
Yeah. I totally get where you're coming from. I mean, the first thought when you say that is of music, and the same thing happens in music, right? And people come up with a new form of music, and it's a genuine way of expressing themselves, and it's shared from person to person. And then a corporation comes along and produces that same kind of music and puts it on albums and sells it to you and then says, you're not allowed to use this music because now we own it. And in that way, they steal culture. And that happens with learning, too. The idea of the MOOC is an example of that, I'm lucky I'm allowed to use the word. There's a lot of words in the history, in our history, that we can't use anymore because some company has bought them. Freenet was open internet access that was created by a community. And some company in the United States trademarked the term Freenet. So we started having to call them community access networks, which was not the same at all as Freenet. What was the word that Guelph tried to trademark? It was something very recently. But there's a history of that, where a concept will come along and it becomes commodified. It's taken by an organization, a Stanford, an MIT, a Pearson, a McGraw-Hill, and it becomes, something that we're not allowed to do anymore because they own it. And there's no easy way around that because that's history. That's the history of everything. It's the history of music. It's the history of beat poetry. It's the history of cubist art. It's the history of graffiti. I'm afraid to take pictures outside now. Okay, I exaggerate. I'm not really that afraid. But and the only answer is constant regeneration, really. The only answer is to keep doing these things anew. I don't know. I think that in the limited sphere of education, at least, as time goes by, it becomes harder and harder for institutions to hang on to the things that have made them monopolies. It's getting harder and harder for institutions and publishers to keep content behind subscription paywalls. It's becoming harder and harder for educational institutions to keep learning behind tuition barriers. In many parts of Europe, tuition is free. In many parts of the world, learning resources are free. In the United States recently, they announced an open content initiative for colleges. It moves slowly forward, at least. We get more access than we used to have. Sometimes it's only because the system of commerce no longer values what we're getting for free. But sometimes they don't have the means of controlling it anymore. People say that digital technology increases the digital divide. I don't think I agree with that. And I don't agree with that because, at least in my own life, I've had more access to more content, and for that matter, more audience than I ever could possibly have had in a pre-digital world. And I think that's true of pretty much every person on the planet, that they could not have accessed this sort of content before, at all, ever. And so we're in one of those moments, I think, in history where the existing institutions still own most of everything, but where there's a possibility that that doesn't matter anymore because what they own is no longer what is valued. And what we can have, the rest of us, becomes what is valued anew. I know that's really vague, but that's the best answer I have. It depends on the day. Sometimes I'm really skeptical. I think this is never going to work. And it's all going to be owned by Disney. And that's a real fear I have, that Disney will own education and everybody will grow up wanting to be like Mickey Mouse. And it's, I don't make that up. That really is the plan. And other days I think, no, we're too smart for that. We'll figure out a way. But then I think of global warming and I think, well, no, maybe we won't. So I don't know. But, you know, I do know this. Education won't be free, won't become free unless people work to make that happen. And to me, that's probably the most important thing.
Do you think that the current MOOCs, like Coursera and Netflix, are starting to be more like a fast food learning, where you can earn a certificate very fast, but you are not learning, in fact, because it's very easy to cheat in these courses and so on. So, including a certificate that can be earned that easy, maybe has to be changed in some way, that, like you said, that an expert has to use that skill.
It's funny, that's the one thing I don't accuse them of. And in fact, and maybe I will in the future, but in fact, a lot of these MOOCs have really missed the mark in the sense that they try to be too traditional, too much like restaurant food, if you will. You know, you look at the artificial intelligence course or there's any of these courses, right? Really complex mathematics are in these courses, right? It's hard to pass one of these courses. It's hard to do these courses. I've looked at a bunch of them. And the appeal to the broader audience isn't necessarily there. One example I use is the University of Alberta has a course on dinosaurs. And I thought, perfect. Kids everywhere will love this because kids love dinosaurs. And they do. Oh, they do. But no, they did not love this course because this course was taught at a university level. And, you know, the lesson one, you know, the history and significance of paleontology. No 9-year-old in the world was interested in that. So, and that doesn't mean that we don't have fast food learning. We do, but fast food learning today is in, it's in BuzzFeed, it's in Huffington Post, it's in, well, there's the whole name, the Gawker, and, some of them are good, some of them are less good, but they're all fast food. There's TED Talks, fast food learning, right? TED Talks, take any complex subject imaginable, TED Talks will reduce it to one rebel with a single idea that revolutionized the world. Because that's what TED Talks do. Fast food learning. So maybe MOOCs will become more and more like TED Talks and your criticism will be valid. But right now, I think no, not yet.
Thank you.
Yep.
In your mind, could you mix that move some flipped dragon, or maybe the magnitude of each one is not the same?
So the question is whether I think MOOCs can be mixed with flipped classrooms.
Yeah.
So there is actually a name for that phenomenon. It's called the wrapped MOOC, like saran wrap. And the idea of that is you have a traditional class, but the class wraps around the MOOC. So people at home would study from the MOOCs, and then they'd go into the classroom and they'd be like meta-study, where they'd talk about the MOOC and all of that. So that can work. There's no reason why that would not work. It's the same thing that people do for themselves when they have a meetup, right? A meetup is where they agree to gather in person in a cafe or a pub or someplace, and then they talk about the MOOC. That's exactly the same thing, except there's no teacher. So there's no reason why that would not work. The only stipulation I would make is this, and it's the stipulation that the one thing does not require the other. So, in other words, you can be successful with the MOOC even if you do not attend the class, right? If you must attend the class, then it's no longer open, it's no longer massive, it's no longer online. So that would become a barrier.
Thank you.